Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Carolyn Archie in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, and thank you to Carolyn Archie, who you heard there introducing the show with a voice like molasses. What an absolutely extraordinary, beautiful accent Carolyn has. A wonderful way to start the show. Bit of backstory for you on Carolyn. She won the American Tennis Association National Tournament in the 12 to 15 age bracket in 1957, travelling with the junior team coached by, and friends of the pod might remember this name, Dr. Robert Johnson, the man responsible for mentoring both Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe. He was instrumental in both of their successes. And we are looking right now at a picture of Carolyn with Arthur Ashe, the most extraordinary picture. It's wonderful. So big thanks to Carolyn's daughter, Carol Allen, who is a friend of the pod and sent us all of this info. A reminder that a new edition of Tennis Relived is now available for friends. It's called The Movement. And it recounts David's memories of being at the ATP in the early noughties as the men's tour tried to market the next generation after Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras, language which might be a little familiar to you. We also have two more bonus pods for friends coming soon. Tennis Relived, about the life and career and legacy of Nick Bollettieri, and a Q&A with the three of us. That's all coming in the next week for friends of the pod. So if you would like to become a friend, gain access to all of that, the link to do so is in our show notes. Matt is wearing his Arthur Ashe jumper in tribute to Carolyn and Dr. Johnson and Arthur Ashe. David mistook it for or speculated that it might be an Arthur Feast jumper. Yeah, don't get ahead of yourself, David. No one's making jumpers for him yet.
I thought I would begin the marketing campaign for the next generation, which I'm very much hoping that Arthur Feast is going to be part of. But no, I was just being silly.
Well, David had Arthur Feast on the brain because he'd decided just to have a little look up of his results to see how he was faring in his transition from the juniors to the seniors. Answer, for the time being, not very well. But we still
not
believe.
Not on clay, anyway.
Not on clay. We believe. We believe. Matt, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Yes, I just loved that intro backstory so, so much. I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I need to be good on today's podcast because that's a high bar early to lead
it
with
is,
that.
Isn't it? So yeah, big thanks to Carolyn's daughter, Carol Allen, for telling us all of that. And big thanks to Carolyn for that wonderful intro to this edition of the Tennis Podcast, which is brought to you in association with On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. On Location took us to Indian Wells last month. My tan has faded. It's a sorry state of affairs. But it does mean that we can vouch for the brilliant experiences that they provide at tennis tournaments. They provide packages via Steve Fogel's International Tennis Tours to all of the four Grand Slam tournaments, including the US Open, which is on sale now with fantastic seats, hospitality, hotel packages available for the year's final major event at Flushing Meadows in New York. Go to, and we have a new URL for you today, folks. So hold on to your hats. Go to onlocationexp.com/TTP to see what they have to offer. That is onlocationexp. What's E in epsilon?
Looking forward to this. Echo?
Echo. xraypapa.com/TTP Tango Tango Papa. There we go.
Very good.
Should have thought through the phonetic alphabet before embarking upon that. But there we go. Right then, without further ado or more ado, let's start talking about the week that has been in tennis. We most prominently had two 500 events on the women's side in Stuttgart and on the men's side in Barcelona. Those events were won by Iga Świątek and Carlos Alcaraz. Surprise, surprise, folks. In Stuttgart, we had the world numbers 1 and 2 facing off in the final. Iga Świątek beating Aryna Sabalenka 6-3, 6-4 in what, until 3-all in the first set, was shaping up to be really, really epic. I thought there was a tingle in the air. There was a real sense of atmosphere. It was a packed crowd, as it so often is in Stuttgart. It's such a well-attended event and really well-staged. And there was a crackle in the air, a feel of, this is something special here. This could end up being a Graf Selles type thing. We might be able to look back in 10, 20 years and say, God, we saw Świątek and Sabalenka facing off at their respective peaks. How cool was that? And up until 3-all in the first set, I felt like it was that match. And then Świątek found an extra gear, a gear that she might not have been able to find were it not on a clay court. It was a reminder for me, that match, certainly the acts 2 and 3 of that match were a reminder of what Świątek, as brilliant as she is on hard courts, and she is, what she has on clay above and beyond the others.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think it was significant that she found that gear, because that's been what has been missing from Iga Świątek's season so far. You know, whenever she's come up against a player going toe-to-toe with her with a lot of power, be it Jessica Pegula right at the start of the season in United Cup or Elena Rybakina on a couple of occasions, Świątek hasn't quite been able to stay with those opponents and has ended up losing in straight sets. But here, she found that extra gear, and I completely agree. She has won 41 of her last 44 matches on clay for a reason. And to watch her on that surface is pretty mesmerizing, actually, because she can move and defend and get herself in position just like no one else can, and sort of force Sabalenka to overhit a little bit and make some errors which other opponents weren't able to bring out of Sabalenka. And of course, she's got her own power and ability to hit winners as well. She's just the full package on clay. And yeah, I was so impressed by that performance. I thought Świątek's intensity was matching Sabalenka's right from the beginning, which is, you know, very difficult to do. Sabalenka is one of the most intense players on the tour. And yeah, it was a real treat to watch Iga Świątek play like that, and also to just have this continuation of the WTA season that we've had, where all of the big events have had at least one, if not two, of the very best players in the world in the final. You know, we are seeing the best players play each other more than we have in the past few seasons. And of course, Świątek, Sabalenka, Rybakina are the three that are standing out. And I'm really enjoying seeing these matches week in, week out.
It feels to me, David, I know it's only an ATP 500. I know WTA 500, rather. I know that she won that tournament last year. She has bigger challenges ahead in this clay court season. But it actually felt to me like quite an important win for Świątek, both the tournament and that final over Aryna Sabalenka. Because while she's been world number one and she's had a great season so far, actually she's been sort of the third most spotlighted player this season. She has been in the shadow of Sabalenka and Rybakina. I think she needed to say, she needed to be making that statement, okay, in Daniil Medvedev's voice, but we're on clay now. We're on clay now, and this is my house. You are the challengers. Yeah. I'm the one.
I'd agree with that. I think she's been losing the big ones. She's been as dominant as you could be between the big ones of playing against Rybakina and Sabalenka or winning the Grand Slam title that she so seeks. Obviously, that went to Sabalenka at the Australian Open in that incredible final against Rybakina. And yes, we have been sort of loosely talking about a big three. But I remember at the end of Indian Wells, I felt like, oh, she could do with a good Miami. And of course, Miami didn't happen in the end for her. And I think that in hindsight, that must have been a good choice. She'd had some ill health. She'd had an injury, however serious. She'd had something, you know, and she wasn't quite right. And here she is now coming back to her most comfortable surface of the lot. I mean, I think she is the closest thing in tennis that we've got right now to Nadal or Evert, I think, on a surface. I suppose Djokovic at the Australian Open as well, and maybe Wimbledon. But she feels that level of dominance approaching. Obviously, she's not, you know, Nadal's won 14 French Opens. She may win five or something. But it's she's starting to amass a streak, numbers and feel on a surface that it doesn't really matter who she's up against, she's going to get the better of them. And I think it's right. Against Sabalenka, I loved the way in this tournament, because all the big players were playing together, they were all making statement wins every other day. You know, Sabalenka facing Krejcikova and really thrashing her, beating her comfortably a few days ago, and coming to this point and playing as well as she can play, really, looking on that surface anyway, which I don't consider her best surface. She's clearly not as comfortable moving around as Świątek is, but she took it to her. And yet, Świątek is good enough to have the answers. And I think you're right. I think she needed to remind herself against one of those two that her best tennis is still good enough. I don't think there were doubts, but you have to just keep proving it. That's the beauty of this tennis circuit, is they keep meeting all the time.
Be interesting in Madrid, won't it? Because while it is a clay court, it's a very different kind of clay court, isn't it? I mean, Sabalenka has won there before. I think of Sabalenka actually as the type of player, while she's not as comfortable on clay generally as Świątek, in Madrid at the altitude, it could make things a bit different. And while I think the conditions in Madrid make it less relevant in terms of French Open form, how things might shake out in terms of a sort of a blueprint for the French Open. You know, if these players are going to be meeting, you know, more weeks than not, then the head-to-head starts getting important, doesn't it? Whether you've had recent wins over your rivals becomes a factor. And I don't know, we get ahead of ourselves, but if they were to meet again in Madrid, I think Sabalenka's got to be making the most of the advantage that the conditions give her to get a W there. Oh, God, that sounded so American. I instantly hated myself when I said that. I'm so sorry.
Are you going to use clutch and winningest in a minute as well?
Winningest. what else happened in Stuttgart this week? Ons Jabeur, injured, desperate heartbreak, just as she had sort of hit this extraordinary form out of nowhere that we were talking about from Charleston. She looked pretty much back to her best in Charleston, which, as discussed, seemed to come from nowhere, but we were all very much here for it. And she seemed to be continuing that on the indoor European clay. And then she gets this calf injury, which was clearly very acute from the outset, wasn't it, in her semi-final? And it's all a very unclear picture now for Ons Jabeur. So basically, scrub all of the excitement that we expressed in the podcast. It was two podcasts ago, wasn't it? The one we recorded a bit late. Just go back. We just go back and edit that out, David, maybe.
No, honestly, that I let's just hope it's not serious, because it was exciting as a prospect, that semi-final, because I feel as though Jabeur believes in herself sufficiently and has been, when she really gets on a hot streak, she just does, she brings something different to the table that she believes in, I think. And even against Świątek, she believes in it. She's going to take it to her. And I feel like she's got less of a steady floor of level than the others have got. But my goodness, when she gets a spark, like a little peak in her form, it can take everybody out of the equation. And I would love to have seen that with her fully healthy in this match, because, you know, she was coming in with some seriously good wins and a run of form. And yeah, I mean, calf injuries are not fun. I mean, you've got to be careful with that.
And now points to defend in Madrid.
Mm, yeah.
1,000. No, fewer than 1,000 to defend in Madrid, of course.
Yeah, she's still in the Madrid draw at the time of recording, but I guess she's going to see how it goes this week before she has to take to the court. I did quite enjoy Iga Świątek apparently said to Ons Jabeur on the court, you know, when Jabeur had to retire, I'll see you in the Roland Garros final, or we're probably going to play the Roland Garros final, which I thought was both indication of the confidence that Iga Świątek feels on this surface, that she's happy to go around saying that, and also, you know, could well be the case. I think that was the Roland Garros final that a lot of people were predicting last year, but obviously Ons Jabeur crashed out on the Sunday of the French Open. But if Jabeur is fit, I definitely think that's a possible Roland Garros final based on how good we've seen Jabeur be on this surface.
Was that also potentially a very, very sly way of poo-pooing the concept of, quote, the new big three from Iga Świątek? And could that have been a source of some of the aggro between Sabalenka and Świątek in that final? Because it wasn't pantomime aggro. It was like a simmering, slightly uncomfortable edge to that match. And there were moments where I wondered if I was imagining it, because I thought, oh, no one's got beef with Iga Świątek. And then Aryna Sabalenka hit a full body shot overhead at Iga Świątek. I mean, in her slight defence, this is only minor mitigation, Świątek did seem to be sort of charging towards the ball as Sabalenka hit it. But she had the whole court open, Sabalenka, and Świątek really had to dodge out of the way. And she did hold her hand up in apology, Sabalenka, but her back was turned to Świątek. It was not a warm, genuine apology that you might expect from somebody that's just sort of done an attempted murder.
I must say, I thought that was mostly on Świątek. You know, she completely ran towards this smash at full pace, and Sabalenka was literally on top of the net. I guess Sabalenka may well have seen Świątek out of the corner of her eye, but she was focused on putting that ball away. I don't think she was expecting Świątek to be right there. The one that got me was the handshake at the end. It wasn't a warm handshake like Sabalenka very often gives. It was quite short. It was quite curt.
Good.
It was very cold, and that continued into the, you know, there's that awkward period of time after finals, isn't there, where the winner and the runner-up have to pose with their trophies side by side, where a David Law type figure is sort of pointing them and telling them where to smile. And usually there's a little bit of jolliness, isn't there? Usually the runner-up has to just sort of smile through gritted teeth and just do a bit of perceived bants, and there was nothing, not even eye contact. It was cold. It was really cold.
I did notice that Sabalenka sort of motioned as if to playfully smash her trophy into the Porsche.
David. That was absolutely iconic. Yeah, and did it while Świątek's back was turned as well. I mean, I'm sure she's seen it on social media, but at the time, Świątek would have had no idea that Sabalenka was sort of mock vandalising her new Porsche.
Which Świątek sort of drove at some haste around the court with a lot of small children on it. It did worry me.
It was quite fast, wasn't it? There was a sort of unexplained man in the passenger seat. And I thought, if he's a chaperone,
wasn't that her dad?
Oh, was it?
I heard her dad was present and she was going to give it to her dad.
Well, he should have been telling her to put the brakes on. It was was careering around that court, wasn't she? It didn't a very slippy clay court. I don't know. It made my heart was in my mouth a little bit.
Just on the sort of the frostiness out on the court between the two, if that's indeed what it was, and I think there was, you know, look, you're right, it wasn't all jolly and cuddly. My first reaction is good. I like to see that because I want them to really want to win and not be afraid to show it. And they're two players that expect to win when they're in big matches, and I love that about them. They both bring it, and I think Sabalenka was really pissed off not to win, and she showed it. The other element that has to be considered is whether this was war related, in terms of Iga Świątek's very vocal, very visible, and continuous support of Ukraine by wearing the flag on her hat and by continually referencing Ukraine in her speeches. And obviously Sabalenka from Belarus, a player who was banned from Wimbledon last year, as all the Russian and Belarusian players were. Who knows whether she feels put out by Świątek effectively calling for those players to be banned, or at least supporting that as a measure. Maybe not in so many specific words, but I mean, I think that is definitely the suggestion. And who knows? I don't have evidence of that, but I mean that could be part of it from both sides. But generally speaking, I think we are overdue a rivalry in which two players don't exactly ham it up as friends and just are prepared to just come and be competitors against each other.
Yep, I'm absolutely fine with it as well. I just think it's notable because of the people involved. You don't usually see that from them. But yeah, I've got absolutely no problem with it at all. Over in Barcelona, the 500 event there was won by Carlos Alcaraz. He beat Stefanos Tsitsipas 6-3, 6-4 in the final. Just before we talk about that match and the tournament, we've got a fairly good comparison point here. It's Stuttgart and Barcelona, both 500-level events, same ranking points on offer, similar depth of fields in terms of top players, very, very similar winners in terms of stature, status, star power. Here are the respective prize money checks that Alcaraz and Świątek took home. For Alcaraz, it was €477,000. And for Iga Świątek, it was €104,000. The crowds were packed for both tournaments. I couldn't see a spare seat in the house for Stuttgart. And as I say, that is pretty much always the case there. And for anybody saying, oh, but Świątek won a car. Yeah. And if this were an anomalous prize money disparity, then maybe the car would be an explanation. But this is not in any way an anomalous prize money disparity. I mean, there are bigger disparities between equal-sized events, even in the same location on the tour. What was the prize money, David, for the ATP 250 in Doha relative to the WTA 500 in Doha earlier this year?
It was $209,000 to Daniil Medvedev for winning the ATP Doha 250, and Iga Świątek won less than a third of that for winning the 500 event, $68,000. So, you know, same place, different week, as a lot of people point out, different tours, but that is a staggering difference in prize money.
It's staggering, and it's just unacceptable. It's just unacceptable. I know there are a million reasons. This isn't recriminations on the WTA for that being the case. I know they would desperately love to pay equal prize money and would do it in a heartbeat, and they're not in a position to. And a lot of people would say, you know, this is why they've had to make the decision to go back to China. If they ever want to be able to be up in their prize money game, they have to, you know, prioritize that ahead of ethics. Whatever, whatever, whatever. There is all sorts of whataboutry you can have. But the bottom line is nobody should be considering this acceptable. The men should not be considering this acceptable. I want to hear some men saying, noticing this and going, wow, this doesn't feel right. It's just not right. So we don't need recriminations about it. I know it's a complicated landscape. We just need to all agree this isn't right. What can we do to work towards a world where we have equal prize money rather than, oh, but market forces and, oh, but, you know, you win a car and, oh, but, you know, it's different tours and the WTA is a mess and all of that. Fine. Any of those things might be true, but we can't be having this. And we need to be shouting that from the rooftops and just all agreeing that we need to work towards a solution. And that includes the men.
Well, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal both want combined tours, don't they? Mm. They want them to merge, as they told us on Twitter about 2 or 3 years ago. And loads and loads of people agreed with that. All the men agreed with it at the time. It is quite shocking when you put it out on Twitter, which I do, and I do it every time one of these events happens, and the degree of sexist abuse that I get is staggering, really. The amount of people who just say, how hard is it for you to understand that these are two separate tours bringing in X amount of different amount of money each, and therefore they can't pay the same? The point is, as you've said, isn't it a good idea if they are paid the same? Wouldn't that be good? Wouldn't that be like the dream, the goal, the ideal? And to have combined tours that celebrated both and worked together. And as we've seen, we got Madrid coming up now, combined tournament, paying the same prize money. It's an elevated event. Everybody's going to be there. Yes, it feels a bit too long, and we'll go on to that later. But even so, men and women are playing together, and Andrea Gaudenzi, the chief of the ATP, has said that is when tennis is at its best. Its unique selling position is it's men and women playing the same sport, and it's the best women's sport in the world at the moment. And if it wants to keep its position, then we all need to cherish the fact that we are in that position, I think.
Yeah, look, if your reaction to, and I doubt this is the case for many people listening to this podcast, because we know our listeners and we know how cool you all are. But if your reaction to seeing that prize money disparity is to try and defend it rather than to think, oh, well, how can we try and change that? Then, again, Daniil Medvedev voice, have a look at yourself in the mirror. I really need to work on my, if I'm going to use his line so often, I really need to work on my Daniil Medvedev voice.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Anyway, rant over. As David's alluded to, there might be another rant to come later. A little teaser for you there. But first, Carlos Alcaraz, winning Barcelona, his first time defending a title. Because he is, after all, still a teenager and he's still doing things for the first time. And it was a pretty comfortable victory for him in the end, wasn't it, over Stefanos Tsitsipas? There was... pretty similar to the Stuttgart final, there was a period at the very start where you thought, oh, hang on, could this be interesting? And then, oh no, Alcaraz has got a gear that Tsitsipas doesn't have and potentially nobody else has, and actually he's just better. And that's probably the case on all surfaces for Alcaraz and Tsitsipas right now. I feel like that match should be a tough one to take for Stefanos Tsitsipas. I'd like to really peer into his soul. I take that back. I never want to peer into Tsitsipas's soul. But you know what I mean.
Come on,
I'd like to
experiment.
Really, really know how much that one hurts and how much it makes. Does he... You've got to find a way to walk away from that match and think, okay, but I can do these things better. I can work on these things. I can do this different tactic. And I believe I can beat him. But I don't think he can. I don't think he can beat Alcaraz unless Alcaraz has a bad day. Discuss.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would say to defend Tsitsipas at the moment is that he isn't playing his best tennis right now. I don't think he's at his absolute best. Over the last few months, he's had the injury, even stepping on the clay this past couple of weeks. I don't think it's been... peak Stefanos Tsitsipas. I think he can do a bit better than that against Alcaraz, but even peak Stefanos Tsitsipas, I don't think would be beating Carlos Alcaraz. This was such a complete performance, so dominant. Tsitsipas was getting nowhere near Alcaraz's serve. You know, okay, he broke him early on, but then for the rest of the match, he was barely winning points behind the Alcaraz serve. And on clay, when Tsitsipas has got time to be able to get that sort of slightly problematic return, he's got more time on clay, it's normally better. And it was just exploited. You know, Alcaraz pinned him in the backhand corner, exploited the space, and he was either overpowering him with a forehand that, you know, is pretty much the best in the world, or he was pushing him so far back and drop-shotting him. And I think he ended up with almost double figures drop shot winners from Alcaraz. It was just an absolute masterclass in that performance. And, you know, yet again, we've seen Alcaraz in a big match, just as we saw in Indian Wells against Medvedev in the final, just go up another level. And his performance in that final was better than it had been all week. And yeah, you know, the idea that there would be question marks over Rafa Nadal and Novak Djokovic, we'll come on to that, I'm sure. And yet, to me, the French Open doesn't feel very open. You know, if you'd said that before, that Nadal and Djokovic are both struggling with injuries, you'd think, well, there's probably 5-10 guys who could win the French Open. And it doesn't feel like that to me. It feels like, okay, Nadal and Djokovic would be legitimate contenders, of course. They would be the favourites. But if they're a bit injured, and even if they weren't, Alcaraz is right there and is a level above anyone else in the field. And I think based on his clay court prowess, Tsitsipas would probably be the next guy. And we saw the gap this week between Alcaraz and Tsitsipas. It is pretty scary.
Here's a conundrum for you that it occurred to me. Again, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but last year Alcaraz won Barcelona, he won Madrid, and then he took the decision not to play Rome because, you know, he had the matches he needed. It would have been potentially too much tennis ahead of Roland Garros. And at Roland Garros, he doesn't play his best, quite frankly, does he? He loses out to Alexander Zverev in that match where, you know, he just wasn't firing for the first two sets. And he had to save match point, didn't he, in a previous round. You know, he was never at his Barcelona-Madrid best at Roland Garros. I think the optimum preparation for Alcaraz for the French Open is to be playing Rome and ideally winning Rome. But if he wins Madrid again this year, which there's no Nadal, there's no Djokovic, he is heavy favourite to do, I would say, it's probably potentially a bit too much tennis for him to then go on and play Rome. But then he's not played Rome and he's got a 3-week gap ahead of the French Open. But he can't not play Madrid because that's in Spain. I mean, maybe this is a conversation to be having in 2 weeks' time if he wins Madrid, but it's a bit of a conundrum for him, I think.
Yeah, although I do think this is where, and we're going to have this rant later about the 2 week Masters events, I think that helps him here. You know, last year, if he won Madrid as he did, beating Djokovic and Nadal back to back, that was, you know, a big effort. He'd have had to play 2 or 3 days later in Rome, whereas now he's got probably a week between the, you know, the final of Madrid and his first match in Rome. So I think the equation is a little bit different this year. But I agree, it's an awful lot of tennis to be playing going into a Grand Slam. You know, he's never won 7 5-set matches on clay before. You know, that's maybe even a bit different to doing it on a hard court. So it's definitely something for him to consider. And as you said, he's not going to skip Madrid because it's the home tournament. I think he'll end up playing both this year, though, because of the different schedule.
So we've found something good about the extension of these events to 2 weeks.
I think it's good for him. It is good for him, and it's good for contenders generally who want to go all the way, and helps them to be able to play all these events and still feel fresh enough and ready for a Grand Slam. I think he will play both. I think he should be playing both. Last year, I liked the idea of him winning Madrid and then leaving the rest of them to Rome. Didn't work out as I anticipated, but he's a year on. He's a year more experienced. Nadal used to play all of them. And I mean, the question mark over Alcaraz is only one of injuries, I think. I don't think he's going to run out of steam. I don't think he's got an energy problem at all. And I don't think he's going to have an energy problem whether he plays every day between now and the French Open final. But he has been injury prone. So that is a question mark. Mm. We saw it in Miami. He pulled up a bit lame at the end of that tournament. And he needs to avoid that, obviously, ahead of the French Open. So I think you take a view on whether he's injured or not. I agree. I think Rome is really important to him this year. Even if he doesn't win it, he doesn't need to win it to be a massive contender at Roland Garros. I just feel as though the fact that he'll be playing every other day most of the time, plus on a similar surface, even though it's only best of three sets, it gets you into the rhythm of Roland Garros. I think it's good for him. So I'm just quickly, I had a chat with Dan Evans after their semi-final. I wanted to know what he thought of facing Alcaraz versus, obviously, he's had a tough time against players like Tsitsipas and Medvedev in the past. He can't deal with them. And I wanted to know what he thought of him. I know they'd practiced together a few weeks ago, I think in Indian Wells, they practiced together as well. He said facing his serve, he felt like he could get in those games and it wasn't too bad. You know, he said he's got a good flat serve, and obviously that kick serve can put you in the flower beds on the side of the court, which is difficult. But he said, you know, I was 4-love down, and then I got back to 4-2, and I had love 30, and I actually thought, you know, maybe he's getting a bit rattled here. I felt like I could get into his service games, but holding serve against him was just a nightmare, trying to hold against the guy. He said, at the moment, you've got to remember, he's so young, and he still goes for the spectacular a lot, and that makes him kind of a bit loose. His game is a little bit loose still at the moment. I mean, I think it's a lot tighter than it was a year ago. Like, I don't mean tighter, nervous. I mean, he's tightened it up. There are fewer mistakes coming off his racket than there were a year ago when he had a bad spell. But, you know, Evans, the gist of what he was saying is, in 2 years, if this guy doesn't get hurt, how are you going to stop him? How is anybody going to stop him? Because he will probably have ironed out any of the kinks. And it makes me think that there's a premium on the next 18 months for Djokovic. Mm. That he's got to make hay now in the next 18 months.
Well, he's not going to be making hay in the next 2 weeks, is he? Because he's out in Madrid with this elbow injury that we suspected he was suffering with in Monte Carlo. He was wearing that sleeve, wasn't he? And reports emerged that he had been seen potentially injuring himself or feeling that elbow in practice in the days before Monte Carlo. It's not great for Djokovic. I mean, obviously, you know, we don't know until we see him. The significance of that Monte Carlo defeat, we won't know until we could look back in hindsight and go, well, the evidence was there, wasn't it? He was grouchy, he was injured, he was not happy with the world. But equally, we've seen him lose those type of matches in Monte Carlo plenty of times before, and it's ended up meaning not very much other than it's his first matches on clay of the season and he's adjusting and finding his feet. I don't know, but I can definitely see a world where it's that first scenario. Of course, this is not ideal for Djokovic at all. I know he didn't win Madrid last year. He ran into Carlos Alcaraz, but he played really well in Madrid. It was a significant part of him finding his clay form.
Mm. Yeah, and then he was brilliant again in Rome, and he was then in the flow and ready for Roland Garros. And that's been the pattern of his clay court season recently. Slow start, look good in Rome, and then absolutely fine for Roland Garros. And it's, you know, it's either taken Rafael Nadal to stop him or he's won the title. And what's different is the elbow. You know, as you said, if it was just a slow start, if it was just him not looking so good, I would think it was exactly the same as previous years. But the elbow is an issue, and especially, I think, on clay, because that's the surface where he has to muscle the ball a little bit more and try and get it through the surface. You know, we talk so much about Djokovic having deceptively a lot of power, and because he's such a clean ball striker, he can get the ball through the court, but that's mainly on a grass court and a hard court. On clay, it's a lot of effort for him to hit through opponents, and he just couldn't do it against Dusan Lajovic on a very, very slow court, and also in his first match against Luka Van Asch. He was just really struggling this week, and yeah, he appears to be in a bit of pain as well. So it's definitely it feels to me like a different picture to the last few years for Djokovic. There's still time for him to heal that elbow and be at his brilliant best, but I wouldn't be so sure that this is going to be the same clay court season that we've seen from Djokovic recently.
Yeah, there was a moment when Djokovic was trailing to Luka Van Asch in his opening match in Banja Luka last week, where, you know, the Alcaraz-Mataz WhatsApp group was alight with, oh my God, Djokovic is losing to someone we've never heard of. And then my brother not so quietly pointed out that actually Luka Van Asch was somebody he had signposted a few months ago after dropping Luka Nardi like a hot potato when he went on a streak, which he is still on, of not being able to win any kind of tennis match. He transferred his fandom to Luka Van Asch. Apparently he's very good, David, and we should be popping him in the Art of Feasts box of
jumper
frogs. Let's not get carried away. No. Let's not get carried away. staying in Banja Luka, Lajovic went on to win the title, didn't he? Beat Djokovic in the quarters and then beat Andrei Rublev 6-3, 4-6, 6-4 in the final. I know he's won titles before. He's won titles of this size before. Finalist in Monte Carlo. Of course, a few few years ago, but that feels like the week of Dusan Ivic's career. And, well, I was going to say out of nowhere, but actually some people have been giving pretty hot Ljubic hot takes in certain WhatsApp groups for a few weeks, a month now, David Law.
Well, he's had a couple of good wins earlier in the year, and he's just not been losing early. He's somebody who is really very different when he's playing well to when he's not. You don't necessarily just get this standard level from him. He's either really, really looks slow and as though everybody can take advantage of him, and he does struggle on the faster surfaces, I think. Stick him on this, a slow hard court, or even better, a slow clay court, where he's looping ground strokes. And, to use Matt's description of having to muscle the ball, well, Dusan Ljubic looks like a rugby player, and he can muscle a ball. And it was the worst nightmare for Djokovic to play somebody like this on a clay court like that, particularly if you've got a bit of a dodgy elbow. And so, yes, I mean, I have been saying for a while that I think Ljubic is gonna get some results. I didn't expect him to win this, but it was brilliant the way he did it. And he was superb. And I mean, to beat Rublev in the final when Rublev's just won a clay court 1000, you know what floor he always brings. So I think a fantastic achievement, and I don't think you can underestimate how big a deal it is to beat Djokovic, because the Serbian players so revere and love the man, it's not that easy to put him away. And he had to do it, and he did it really well. Just on Djokovic, I feel like we've seen it too many times before where he has not been 100%, not been playing well, but he gets it right. He gets it right for the major. And he did it in Australia this year when he got a hamstring tear. I think not playing Madrid is really smart. Couple of extra weeks off. He's never liked Madrid. He's never liked it. He loves Rome. He feels like the man in Rome. So go there, feel fresh and be ready. But the elbow is obviously... how can I know whether that's serious or not? I can't. And he's had a big problem with it in the past.
Yeah, I agree. And Dusan Ljubic has had a Carlos Alcaraz problem this year. He's lost to him in Buenos Aires, Rio and Miami. You know, what could Dusan Ljubic's season have been if Carlos Alcaraz wasn't there? I mean, he's literally lost to sort of the best player in the world, or one of the best players in the world, at three tournaments. He's finally shown up at an event that Carlos Alcaraz isn't in, and he's taken out Novak Djokovic and won the title. And it was incredibly impressive, as David said, how he got over that line against Djokovic and then backed it up. You know, it's very hard to do that, I think, when you've had such an emotional high. He then backed it up in the semi-final, also against a Serbian. He beat three of them. He beat Krajinovic, Djokovic and Kecmanovic. It's like a sort of Serbian Davis Cup team just route to the final, and then to take out Rublev. And I don't think of Ljubic as a great closer. I think he can get quite tight, and he did need his double break in that final set. But great scenes when he got over the line. Really, really special moment for him. It was nice to see.
Got through a whole segment on Dusan Ljubic without saying agricultural. Now, speaking of not great closers. I give you Bertik van der Zandschulp.
Oh, dear. I do feel for him. I do.
Yeah. In the words of his post on Twitter, this one hurts. And I think it might for quite a long time. Lost in the Munich final to Holger Rune, who won 6-4, 1-6, 7-6, served for the match three times, did yep. Bertik van der Zandschulp. Two match points, although it felt
four
like
match
more.
Points.
Four
match points. Four, yeah. That's why it felt like more. and desperate, desperate heartbreak. He's never won a title. Yeah. Who wants to take this?
Do you know, just
we're all just grimacing at one another.
I mean, it was very interesting listening to the commentators talking about how he's got this sort of easy power. He looks like he doesn't have any tension in his game and in his strokes, and he's hitting winners galore, and you're not quite sure where the power comes from. And then suddenly that just stopped completely, and his arms looked like lead weights, and he couldn't swing through the ball anymore. And look, you've got to give credit to Rune for extracting this from him when he's going through all sorts of physical issues down the other end of the court. But Van der Zandschulp should have won this match. There is no question about it. And my alarm bells were ringing by looking at Paul Harhaus on the side of the court, who's a very relaxed, amiable, gregarious chap. And he did not take his eyes off his countrymen for a second in the last 5-6 games. And I just sensed that he knew that his man needed help to get over the line. And it was horrible watching him. I mean, it's the beauty of the sport. I love that about the sport, that it does this to people. But they couldn't be more different in that respect, Rune and Van der Zandschulp. Rune just becomes this little mongrel of a tennis player who's just going to drag it out and make you beat him. And then, oh, poor old Bortic. He could be one of those players that we're talking about in this regard several times more.
Well, this defeat makes it more likely that we'll be talking about it again, doesn't it? Because that is serious baggage that he's carrying on his shoulders now. Yeah. I feel like we're all carrying a bit of it, but obviously he's carrying the majority of the scars there.
There's something so cruel about a tennis match like that, because I was having such a great time watching it. Honestly, it was so fun. I was hanging on every point.
It was great.
And yet, Bortic van der Zandschulp's having the worst experience of his life. And of course, I felt for him in that moment, but he was contributing to my fun. And you know, it's a very weird to sort of reconcile all those feelings. But David's right. He just got so tentative in the rallies, and Holger Rune had hurt his shoulder. You know, I was thinking, oh gosh, Holger Rune is going to be another withdrawal from Madrid. You know, he's sort of falling apart. He's played so much tennis. Rune could not hit through his forehand for about 3 or 4 games in the middle of that final set. And yet Van der Zandschulp kept hitting it to Rune's backhand. And he just thought, you've got to be way more ruthless than that. And he just wasn't. There was a really bad double fault on one of the match points. It was your classic choke, I'm afraid. And serving for it 3 times, you know, not even twice, you know, 3 times. But Rune was probably, as David said, just such a pest to have down the other end of the court, because I think he smelt blood a little bit. He sensed that Bortic van der Zandschulp was nervous. And he said in his interview, he tried everything to just make it uncomfortable and come back. And, you know, you've got to credit those competitive instincts of Rune and that high tennis IQ that we talked about. You know, even with a limited game, he was still able to sort of make it work. And, yeah, it was a very dramatic final, and I enjoyed yesterday so much with all the finals. They were spaced out well enough that I could absolutely focus on the 2 500 level finals and watch them in their entirety, and then just hop in for these really fun moments of the other two finals. It was a very enjoyable tennis watching afternoon.
Yeah, for once, and I'm quite sure this was entirely by accident, because tennis, but for once the scheduling of multiple finals on a Sunday actually worked out pretty well. The spacing was pretty good. There was a bit of overlap, but kind of, as you say, Matt, fun overlap. That sort of slightly buzzy early rounds of a slam type overlap. There was no sort of two great matches starting at exactly the same time type thing, which is usually the shooting itself in the foot that tennis usually does to itself. This week and next week, we have Madrid, as we've alluded to. The main draw starts on Wednesday, but it won't be till the weekend, really, that feels like it really gets going, because the draw has been expanded this year to 96 There are 32 seeds and all 32 of them get a bye in the first round. Ben Shelton has a bye in the first round. Yurita Hechka has a bye in the first round. I just think that's rubbish. The main draw starts on Wednesday. Nadal, Djokovic both out. Sinner is out too, and Jack Draper, he's having an injury blighted season, isn't he, Jack Draper. The men's draw is Alcaraz at the top in the top half, Andrei Rublev's in there, Holger Rune, Casper Ruud, and the bottom half is Felix Auger-Aliassime, Stefanos Tsitsipas, Taylor Fritz, Daniel Medvedev. Andy Murray is playing Madrid, which is interesting because after his horrible loss to Alex de Minaur in Monte Carlo, which he described as one of his worst performances in years, and it was bad, it was ugly. He said he was questioning whether he would even continue to play the clay. But here he is, he's playing Madrid, and obviously he played well in Madrid last year, did Andy Murray. So that'd be interesting. Could play Daniel Medvedev in round two. And here's a round one match for you. Dominic Thiem against Kyle Edmund.
That makes me a bit sad.
Yeah, it makes me sad as well.
Neither one of them are anything like what they
no.
were.
No. Okay, moving on to the women. Świątek.
Can I just stay on sad men for a while? And
sure.
Well, I just feel there's been a big Nadal update since we recorded a podcast.
Yes.
And it's...
Casually said there, Nadal's out of Madrid. But yes, it is bad. Go on then.
Well,
let's be sad for a bit more.
Well, he posted a video and it was basically explaining that the psoas injury that he had at the start of the year is way worse than he was first told and first thought. He originally thought it would be a 6 to 8 week recovery. We're now in week 14. And he's trying a new treatment because, you know, it's not right. He's not able to compete. And it sounded like he'd stopped playing for a few days, stopped training for a few days while he had this treatment. And yeah, it's just very downbeat, I thought. No time frame on his possible return. And yeah, it feels worse than the news we had, you know, even a week ago or so that he was, you know, not quite ready for Madrid. I suppose I interpreted that as he's at least able to play and is fit. He's just, yeah, not quite ready. But actually, it sounds like he's actually still injured. And I think that's a different picture, I suppose, to what we had before. And what is it? I think 34 days away from Roland Garros starting. It just, time is running out.
It's never good when there's a video with the update, is it? Yeah, it's not good. Świątek is the top seed in the women's. Rybakina, Pegula, Kazatkina, all in her half. Bottom half is Goff, Jabeur, Garcia, Sabalenka. A potential Raducanu Świątek matchup in round two. So, as we've alluded to, we've got Madrid and Rome, as with all the 1,000 events, bar Monte Carlo, extended to be two-week events. We've established one positive from this. Who would like to take the reins on the rant?
Well, look, I don't find it great entertainment in the first week of any of them, and we've got about five of them now. So that's a downside. And I don't like buys generally, and there are 32 in each draw. So it's all just, I just don't really care for about another 6 days, and we've got kind of a dead week now until that starts. On the whole, though, I think there are enough plus points to pretty much negate the weaknesses in it. And I would say that I think it's very difficult to play these things back to back unless you have them over this length of time. And I think it'll help Rome. I think it'll help Roland Garros ultimately. And probably lead to stronger fields in the long run, although Madrid does seem to be pretty decimated in, at the top of the men's draw. But yeah, I only come from it from a spectator standpoint. I just get on with it. I want to watch the tennis. And there's about 6 days where I don't care.
I think what we found in Indian Wells and Miami, I know they've, you know, they've been longer events for a while, but even that second week I find is diluted, you know, because you get an amazing middle weekend where all the seeds start playing and, you know, that stretches into Monday and Tuesday with a lot of matches happening everywhere. But the last 4 or 5 days of the tournament really drag out because there isn't that much tennis to play. And so I just feel like the rhythm of these tournaments is all wrong. I take David's point that it's maybe better than having them back to back, you know, like they have been in the past. But, you know, if they've got all this time in the calendar, then, you know, I would have a week off between them and pack them each into a week. So you're making the most of those weeks. It just feels like we've got sort of a month now of Madrid and Rome, and there's going to be a handful of brilliant days of tennis. You know, the rest of it is going to be one or two good matches on a day. Whereas what I love about a Masters is that, you know, start to finish, it's packed with great matches, especially when they're combined events. And I just think we're losing that a little bit. But, you know, we know the reasons why, and, you know, I don't mind fitting an extra weekend in. I think that's probably quite a good idea. But for me, as a viewing experience, it's diminished the longer the event goes on.
Right. That is your lot for rants this week and for everything this week, quite frankly, except for mascot news. This week we have Snorri. And Snorri is owned by Sue Barker. Not the Sue Barker that you're thinking of, but a different Sue Barker. Sue says Snorri was born in a barn on a farm in southern Wisconsin a little over 16 years ago to a mother who, and I've been thinking about this all morning, to a mother who I was told had had two different litters at the same time from two different fathers. Isn't nature amazing? Although she's not from a pure breed background, she looks just like a Russian blue and has their personality characteristics of being smart and playful. She particularly loves to fetch her stuffed animals and to chase and bat around her cat-sized tennis ball. She sounds like Billie Jean, which usually gets lost under a piece of furniture. Other interests include sleeping behind the TV on the cable box, I presume because it's warm, and keeping track of everything that happens in the kitchen. She does sound very smart, doesn't she? She is beautiful, is Snorri. And yeah, what a backstory. You learn something new every day. So thank you, Sue. And thank you, Snorri. There'll be a picture of Snorri in our newsletter this week. We have our mascots. David has Maisie. I've got Xenia. And Matt has Darwin. Billie Jean King is sponsored by... Nope, got that the wrong way around. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And we have shout-outs, Matt.
We've got James Nathan, who is originally from Auckland, but now living in Hong Kong.
Oh.
Hi, James.
Hello, James. Like James Connors.
Scott Connors. I always feel like I have to say Scott.
James Scott
middle.
Connors, yes. James Blake is better,
you can say
though.
Jimmy Ooh. Connors or James Scott Tom Connors.
James Ward.
Yeah.
James Duckworth.
Yes. Very good. Do we have any Nathans?
We're on a roll.
No, we don't, is the answer to that, James.
Cheers, James.
Thank you, James.
We've also got Gregor Schlosser, who is in Berlin.
Right, Gregor. And
hello, Gregor. Well,
Gregor reminds me that Laver Cup is coming to Berlin in 2024.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it's Vancouver this year and Berlin next year, isn't it? Two of my...
Gregor's very excited about that.
Wish list destinations.
You can go and be our Laver Cup correspondent, Catherine, and then take in the sights.
Yeah, I'm very keen to go to Vancouver. And Berlin. Yes, well, thank you, Gregor. Almost like Gregor, but better. Yeah. Better Gregor.
I think there is a Gregor, you know. I think there is a Gregor tennis player, and I am just going to try and look him up, and I've got it. It is Gregor Zemlja, a retired Slovenian tennis player, although I don't think the spelling is quite right. It's it says G-R-E-G-A. So it doesn't quite work.
Different name, David.
I think that's just an entirely different name.
Thank you, Gregor.
And finally today, we've got Vicky Spreadbury. We know Vicky.
Oh.
Hey.
And
hello, Vicky.
We love Vicky.
Vicky, who is excellent, says, in case you're struggling, I've looked for a Vicky in tennis. She says, I'm not a Victoria,
Duval.
Which rules out many.
Duval.
Well, Vicky has come up with Vicky Berner, a Canadian player, Virginia Slims tour director and captain of the winning US Fed Cup team in 1977, 78 and 79.
Okay, that's better than Vicky Duval. Thank you, Vicky. This is a great new development. People doing the... Gregor could have found old Gregor for you, David.
Zemlja.
Yeah. Except he wouldn't have because he's got a different name. But anyway, thank you, Vicky, for your continued support. We love Vicky.
Yeah, thanks, Vicky.
And for doing our research for us. We love that. Thanks to all friends of the pod for making this thing happen. And likewise, thanks to On Location for sponsoring the pod at the moment. A reminder that we have coming your way, or coming the way of friends of the pod, a Tennis Relived this week focusing on Nick Bollettieri, and a Q&A which we'll be recording in person tomorrow. And we can't wait for that. So Matt, David, I'll see you tomorrow. Listeners, thank you for listening. We'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.